Very good to be with everybody here today. If you're tuning into our live stream and this is your very first experience with the East Shelby Church of Christ, then I want to encourage you to reach out to our congregation with any questions or comments that you have. You can find more information at eastshelby.com. You can find a lot of our material, previous lessons, and other recordings of our live streams on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/eastshelby. If you're visiting with us in person today, we're very excited by your presence. We hope that this has been an edifying and encouraging experience for you so far. And again, if you have questions about our church, then we would love to sit down, open up our Bibles together, and talk about whatever it is that's on your mind of a spiritual matter. It's always a little bit shocking when the scripture reader comes up and asks, well, what's the scripture reading for today? And you say, well, open up to Song of Solomon. It's, wow, we don't use Song of Solomon in our scripture readings very often. Well, I want to talk about marriage this morning. And in particular, I want to talk about boring marriage. I think you'll see where I'm going with this here in just a few moments. But by way of introduction, I understand that when we talk about a subject like marriage, this is not going to be the most easily applicable lesson for everybody in this assembly or everybody who's watching online. And that could be for a variety of reasons. Perhaps you're just somebody who's not married. You're a young person, a teenager, a child, someone in college, and you're just not married. So you might be wondering, what can I possibly get out of a lesson on marriage? Perhaps the case may be that you've been divorced, and so marriage for you is a very difficult subject to talk about and listen to because of the heartbreak and heartache that's associated with that. Perhaps you've been married for a very long time, or you had a very long and happy marriage and your spouse has now passed away. And for a lot of people, and for a variety of reasons, the subject of marriage may be a thorn in your side or a very difficult thing to listen to and talk about. But I want to assure you, there are going to be a number of things that we talk about today that I think have universal application, not just to marriage and to married couples, but to relationships in general. And so even if you're not married, you may find things in this lesson that apply to a lot of different kinds of relationships. Besides that, not every lesson is going to apply to everybody in equal measure. The fact is that sometimes we'll talk about things like parenting and marriage, and we don't have everybody being a married couple or a parent, and we just have to accept that in a large, diverse congregation like ours, there's going to be a variety of lessons that we're going to talk about on occasion. I want to start with this quote from an article called "Relationship Boredom Can Be Deadly." The author said this: "It is very disquieting when quote-unquote perfect marriages end. The ones that are agreeable, orderly, peaceful, the ones that display no rancor, no rages, no infidelity, no egregious acts of galloping selfishness. When such marriages end, everybody is dismayed. How is it possible? They had no troubles at all, we say in disbelief. And maybe that's the key. No troubles at all may mean no challenge, no emotion, no surprises, no change. In other words, boring. Some marriages do die because of boredom. Boring marriages are much more likely to suffer from sins of omission rather than sins of commission. What isn't done gets such marriages into more trouble than what is done." I think it's an astute observation that he makes is, you know, you can look at some marriages and you go, there was never adultery in that marriage. There was never infidelity there. There was never violence. There was never physical abuse in that marriage. So why did that marriage fall apart? Why did those two people drift apart when on the outside it seems like, boy, nothing ever happened in that marriage. Nothing ever went wrong. And like the author points out, sometimes those marriages suffer not because of what people do to each other, the acts of commission, you know, committing something wrong, but it's the things that are omitted from that marriage. It's the fact that there is nothing interesting going on. It's the fact that there is no communication. Nobody challenges anybody else. Nobody pushes anybody else. Ideas are never challenged. Preconceptions are never challenged. And when you're married to someone who doesn't push you and challenge you and motivate you to be the very best that you can be, when there's not a little bit of iron sharpens iron in a marriage, It's no surprise when that marriage begins to fall apart at the seams and people begin to drift apart. Boredom is the silent killer in many marriages because we don't even realize that it exists until sin has somehow crept in and set in our lives. Often, married couples will look at each other after a couple of decades and realize that they just don't like who they're staring at, or at the very least, they're emotionally unattached and indifferent. I do think sometimes when people get married, and especially after a few years and they start to have children, they don't really think about, like, what's the end game behind all of this? Right? What's going to be the end game? When we're 30 or 40 years down the road and the kids have come and now the kids are gone, and we're still staring at another couple decades together, I don't think people really think about what was the end game all along. Is your marriage still going to be healthy when the kids have come and gone, and that's not the thing that you have in common on a daily basis? So contrary to our world's common perceptions about marriage, God's intention for matrimony is actually based on long-term, if lifetime, mutual enjoyment and satisfaction and challenge and stimulation. We're actually expected by God to savor the marital relationship even as we get older. I want to make something very clear from the outset. Boring is a relative term, and I'm going to use it as a relative term in this lesson. Because you might be thinking, well, our marriage is kind of boring. Our marriage is very boring. It's a very boring marriage, and we own it. Right? We're very happy to own that fact. So what I mean by boring marriage is a marriage that lacks the stimulation and the engagement that you need to have to keep it going for a lifetime. Now, you might be boring people, and that's okay. I mean, for us, we went on an anniversary date one time. I'm not making this up. We went to Costco on an anniversary date one time. Right? Amen. And last year, we went on a date also last year. Where did we go, Rebecca, last year? I think the Powers were watching our kids last year, and we went on a date. I think we went to like Walmart or something like that. Like, oh, I got to buy socks or something like that. You know? And that's okay. Like for us, a nice evening is you put the kids to bed and you turn on the History Channel and watch a little like Forged in Fire or Food Network, like Chopped or something like that. Like that's a good night. Here's the thing though, is I understand that boring is a relative term. And so the idea of having kind of a quote unquote boring life to other people, that's not the issue. Because if what you do in a marriage works for you, don't try to reinvent the wheel. Do what works in your marriage. And if other people on the outside say, you are really boring people, you look at each other and go, well, we're really happy people. That's what we are. You can call us boring if you want to, but what we do works in our relationship. And so other people might think that's boring, but own it. If that's what works in your marriage, own it. You know, there's a lot of people that don't think English literature is very interesting, like 19th century English literature. But you know what? If you guys love English literature and a little Charles Dickens, go for it. Own it. Love it. If watching Food Network for hours on end is what really, really works in your marriage, and you guys enjoy it, and you savor it, you look forward to it all day long, own it. There's nothing wrong with that. So that's not what I mean by marital boredom. What I mean by marital boredom is when you stop challenging each other and you stop being engaged with each other and you stop sharing with each other and you're not pushing each other anymore and you become emotionally detached from each other. So let's just be clear about those terms that we're using here. Boring marriage is minimal. It's never excessive. Look at a couple of verses here real quick. Notice Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9. I know this isn't on the screen, but I want to make sure that we include this one. It's a very important passage on this subject. In Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, it says, enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, because she is your reward in your life and in all of your labor and toil. Look what he says there. enjoy life, right? Don't just tolerate life. Don't just kind of get by in life. He says, enjoy life with the woman who you love all the days. Now, all the days, I take that literally. When he says, enjoy life with the woman who you love all the days of your fleeting life, he doesn't mean just on the good days or the days of abundance or the days when you have a lot of money in your checking account or the days when you're young and healthy and good looking. He means enjoy your entire life, every day, good days, bad days, days of trial and days of sorrow and days of deprivation. You love life with that woman because you're in this together. Through up and down, good and bad, you're in this together. You got to enjoy that life. Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 18, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. He goes on in verse 19 and says that your marriage should result in exhilaration for you. Are you exhilarated by your spouse? And I don't mean in some kind of like corny way. I just mean, is your spouse still your favorite person in the world? And are you still your spouse's biggest cheerleader? Are you the person that's always going to be there for your spouse, cheering them on, excited for whatever they do, even the boring stuff? Are you exhilarated by your spouse? And are you an exhilarating spouse to that person? You know, boring marriage, like I said, boring marriage is minimal, right? It's always like minimum investment. Give as little as you possibly can. Boring marriages, they're never excessive. They're never over the top. Boring marriages, they don't really care about the fire and the passion. Now, I want to understand something here. Passion may have its downside. And there's a couple of verses on the screen to remind you of that. Proverbs 14, verse 30 says that passion can be like rottenness to the bones. We need to have tranquil hearts, not always going, foot to, you know, pedal to the floor. Passion can have its downside. Passion can even manifest itself in sinful ways, like Colossians 3 and verse 5 points out, that there are evil passions or sinful passions that we have. But don't throw out the baby with the bathwater when it comes to passion. Don't just opt for like minimum investment in a marriage. That same author that we pointed out a few minutes ago said this along these lines. He says, boring marriages are minimal marriages. They're not marriages of excess. They're minimal because they exclude all the excitement of relationship, whether it's conflict or differences, spontaneity, feelings, sometimes being irrational and passionate. Like, that's what keeps a marriage interesting. You wouldn't want to marry someone who is exactly like you. At least I wouldn't. I could not stand living with myself. We'd always be outdoing each other, trying to keep the house clean and like organizing our sock drawer. I wouldn't stand living with somebody like me. And so, you know, as we go through this, we inadvertently throw out the baby with the bathwater because we don't want to have our feelings hurt. Because we don't want someone to know us that well. We don't want to be vulnerable around people, so we keep a guard up all the time. We keep a shield up. We'll let a spouse know us only this far, but absolutely not any more. But when you go to the book of Song of Solomon in the Old Testament, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, tucked right in there before Isaiah, one thing that you notice very quickly in this beautiful little play, this drama that unfolds, is the bride in this, the woman, the female character in this story, she's pining away after her love, who presumably is this shepherd, this poor shepherd, who feels like he's been pushed aside because Solomon shows up with his caravan of riches, wooing the female character. And she's pining away after her poor shepherd who she loves with all her heart. When you read a few passages here in Song of Solomon, you realize that she is fully invested in the person that she loves. Not minimum investment. She doesn't keep a wall up. She doesn't keep a guard up. She's willing to drop her guard and possibly be very, very hurt Because he's willing to be vulnerable with this person. Notice here real quickly, chapter 3, verses 1 through 4 of Song of Solomon. On my bed, night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city, in the streets, in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I did not find him. Now it says in verse 3, the watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me. And they said, have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house, into the room of her who conceived me. In chapter 5, notice what she says in verses 6 through 8. It gets worse here. More painful for her. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. And that does happen. The thing is, when you expose yourself to vulnerability in a relationship, sometimes, just is what it is, your feelings are going to get hurt. It's just how it is. Now she goes on to say, my heart went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but he did not answer me. The watchmen who make the rounds, here's those watchmen again, these rascally watchmen. She says here, they struck me and wounded me. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick. We keep marriages minimal because we don't want to get hurt in a marriage. And there's always the possibility the spouse may harm us, or we'll have our hearts broken by tragedy. And so we keep a tight lid on our deepest sense of commitment. We keep a tight lid on our emotions. And it's very powerful here in the Song of Solomon to see this woman who was so invested in the love of her life that she would even feel love sickness when she was unable to find him in a moment. Notice that she does not keep her love at an emotional distance, even at the possibility of being ridiculed by the people around her. My friends, total emotional commitment can either seem frightening or comforting depending on your perspective. Let me give you a few examples, just some bullet points to consider here. When you are fully emotionally invested in your spouse, the result is that you can expose your deepest and most shameful flaws because you know that he has those same flaws also. And if not those same flaws, then he's got a list of flaws of his own. I think our flaws could rival each other, couldn't they? The mistakes that we've made and the regrets that we have. When you are totally emotionally committed, you can speak your mind in complete honesty, knowing that there is no argument in the world that can separate you. When you're totally committed emotionally, you can be who you are without any facade, knowing that you get to see the other as the true self that you are and that he or she is. When you're totally committed emotionally, you can let your guard down, knowing that this person will never take advantage of that vulnerability. When you're totally emotionally committed, you can be honest about your relationship with God, and you can be honest about some of the struggles that you're having, some of the doubts or the skepticism, a faith that might be chipped away at or frayed on the edges. When you're totally emotionally committed, you can let go of all your hang-ups, your baggage, your preconceptions, because you know that there is strength in leaning on each other rather than on emotional crutches. Excessive marriage may be more challenging, but it's also more rewarding. Proverbs 27 verse 17 says, iron sharpens iron, so one sharpens another. A second point is that boring marriage is functional. It's never emotional. You view the other person as nothing but a function somehow. Let me give you a few examples of that if you're not understanding where I'm getting at with this idea of being functional. You may see this person only one-dimensionally. This person is the mother of my children. This person is the breadwinner in our household. This person is the person with whom I have sex. This person is the one who pays for the house. This person is the one who's the primary name on the checking account. This person is the one with whom I share a business, right? So when you only see your spouse as a function rather than a complete person, you have a boring marriage. Even when we pigeonhole a person as husband, wife, mother, father, and we only think of that person one-dimensionally, I think we're using very limited terms. Let me give you three marriages from the Bible that illustrate what I'm talking about when it comes to a purely functional rather than emotional marriage. And we'll go through these pretty quickly because I know we're running out of time here. The first is from the book of Esther. And if you read in Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 8, we find a king named Ahasuerus. And he has a wife named Vashti. Now, Vashti is incredibly beautiful. I presume the most beautiful woman in all of the empire, at least until they discover Esther. And Ahasuerus is in a merry mood, showing off all of his stuff to his buddies. There's a great festival, and he's just in a really great mood, showing off his treasures. He gives a gold cup to everybody who shows up. I mean, imagine the door prizes, right? The party favors. When you go to a party with Ahasuerus, you walk away with a free golden cup. Oh, that's a pretty good party favor, isn't it? And in his good mood, he says, I'll tell you what, guys. I gotta show off Vashti. Hey, Vashti, come on out here. Leave the veil behind, by the way. I'll show you off. She's offended by the whole thing and refuses to be paraded around. Now, the thing about it is, they had a very functional marriage, not an emotional marriage. He was the emperor, the king, the big guy, and she was the beautiful trophy wife. And he wanted her to function as nothing but the beautiful trophy wife. And when it came time, trophy wife, come on out, parade yourself about, she was not willing to fulfill that function. And you find out later on in the story, their marriage falls apart because it's purely functional, not emotional. A second marriage is one that you read about in the book of Genesis in chapter 30 of Jacob and Leah and Rachel and their two handmaids. Now, we know that Jacob is in love with Rachel. He worked 7 years for her until, whoop, lo and behold, he accidentally married Leah. He gets to work another 7 years so that he can have Rachel as well. And here he is married to two women. On top of that, though, the two women get into a little bit of a sisterly rivalry. And when only Leah is producing children, Rachel gets all fussy about that, brings in her handmaid and says, Jacob, my sister over there is the only one having babies right now. Here, take my handmaid, have a few babies with her, and we count those as my babies. And so Leah says, oh, yeah? Hey, handmaid, get in here. Listen, Jacob, you're going to have some babies with my handmaid because I'm going to be I'm the older sister. I'm going to have more babies. That's the way it is. And so we have this comedy of errors in Genesis chapter 30 where the sisters and their handmaids are all fighting with each other, buying and selling Jacob at one point. Listen, Jacob, I pay good money for you. Get in here. And it's this ridiculous comedy of errors in Genesis chapter 30. You know why? Because their marriage is purely functional. It's not emotional. And I want you to compare two things, maybe in your own Bible study time, just for the sake of our time this morning. But look at the difference between Genesis chapter 29 and verse 20. Genesis 29 verse 20 says that Jacob was madly in love with Rachel so that he could work 7 years for her, and it just felt like no time at all because he was so in love with her. And he goes from being madly in love with Rachel to Genesis chapter 30 and verse 1, where Rachel tells him, give me children or else I die. That's how bad their marriage had gotten. To where they were madly in love with each other, to give me children or else just kill me. I'm dead. I'm done. Because their marriage is purely functional, not emotional. And Abigail and Nabal from 1 Samuel chapter 25. I can only assume, and this is just Ryan's assumption here, that in this story, a woman as awesome as Abigail and a guy as stupid as Nabal could only have been married because of some arranged marriage for economic purposes, right? That she was arranged with him. It was good for her family. It was good for his family. I look at them as a couple and I go, how did those two ever end up together? Abigail is awesome. Abigail is one of the greatest women in the entire Bible, and Nabal is a moron. Sorry. There's probably parents in here that are going, kids, we don't use that word in our household. I'm sorry. Well, I should not say that. But just listen to Abigail's own, her own assessment of her husband. She goes to David and says, listen, he's a moron because he's Nabal, and that's exactly what he is. It's our own words. It's our own words. But again, this marriage, at least in all likelihood to me, was probably an arranged marriage for economic purposes between two families. It was a functional marriage, not an emotional marriage. But then you compare those marriages to Proverbs 31, verse 29, where a husband whose heart is swelling with pride says of his wife, "Many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all." Or Song of Solomon 2 and verse 2, where the poor shepherd boy says of his beautiful love, "Like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens." Or what she says of him in chapter 5 and verse 10, "My beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000 men." Is that how you look at your spouse? Outstanding among 10,000. A lily among thorns. Emotional, not just functional. And the last point that we'll make is this. Boring marriage lacks true companionship. Boring marriage is uninteresting. Now, I'm generally a good talker. I'm going to like to talk to people. And I don't mind talking to folks. You know, going to someone's living room and having a good conversation, find out their life story. But have you ever had one of those times where, you know, you're just talking with someone and you're just counting down the minutes until it's like socially appropriate to go, "Well, I better be going now." Because you know what? There's just some people that aren't very interesting. And I think marriages fall apart because people just aren't interested in each other anymore. You just don't care anymore. Are you interested in your spouse? Like really interested, like you care about what she's doing, what he is doing, what their hobbies are, what their interests are, what their music is, what their favorite books are. Do you know stuff about your spouse? Do you care? And do you savor the differences between the two of you? You know, one is tomato, one is tomato, one is white gravy, one is brown gravy, right? Do you savor the differences between the two of you? Because oftentimes it's in those differences that you find the most sparks, right? The most excitement. Boring marriage is boring. So that same author that I quoted earlier at the beginning of the lesson had this final quote here. "Finally, you are forced to suffer a boring marriage when you don't know how to make it interesting. As a nation, we've become so dependent on the entertainment industry for stimulation that we've lost the ability to stimulate ourselves and thus," and I like the way he puts this, "to draw forth what is interesting in our partners." Now, I certainly think that a healthy marriage, there's a place in a healthy marriage for just being quiet with each other, right? And I think that's actually a sign of a good marriage. If you can go on a 5-hour road trip and not feel the need to talk the entire time, and you can just be comfortable on a road trip just being quiet, I actually think that's a sign of a really healthy marriage. So I'm not saying you have to talk to each other all the time about everything in the world. But do you care about your spouse? Do you still find your spouse interesting? I think more to the point, are you doing stuff together? Are you interacting with each other? Are you finding meaningful, substantial things to share in your lives? Are you exercising together? Now, Rebecca and I don't exercise together. She did not like exercising with me because, like, one of my legs, like, is taller than she is. And so I'm galloping along like a giraffe and, you know, I'm not going to describe her as any kind of animal because I know in off the cuff, there is nothing I can say in this moment that will be favorable to her. So I'm not going to say she's like a little squirrel with a fluffy tail. Okay, just come forward as we stand and sing. There's no recovering from that. But are you doing things like exercising together? Are you playing games together? Are you reading the same book and then talking about it later? We were reading Treasure Island, and I was reading it out loud with all the pirate voices included. You can't read Treasure Island without the pirate voices. Are you going on vacations alone? Are you going on vacations together? Are you studying the Bible together? Do you ask each other interesting questions? Like in your daily Bible reading, do you come away from your daily Bible reading and go, man, I did not understand why that character did that, or, oh, that was a really interesting chapter, or I don't understand what happened here in this passage. Are you going to church activities together? Are you getting involved more in church activities? My friends, we are companions. We are best friends. We're not business partners. We're best friends. There are plenty of other relationships that lack engagement and stimulation, so never let your marriage become one of them. Song of Solomon 5, verse 16. This is actually my favorite verse in Song of Solomon, where she says of her beloved, "This is my beloved, and he is my friend." They were friends. Remember, Aquila and Priscilla from the book of Acts, they traveled together. They had Bible studies together. They took on the world together. Remember, Paul praised this diligent Christian couple in Romans chapter 16, verses 3 through 4. Adam and Eve is another great example. I don't want to be dramatic or overstated here, but Adam and Eve were literally discovering the world together. I mean, Adam and Eve, every animal that they saw, everything that they ate, every weather pattern, the very first time there was thunder and lightning, they saw that together. The very first time. I mean, imagine how stimulating and exciting that must have been to be Adam and Eve discovering the world with each other. Do you and your spouse explore anything? And if marriage has become boring, then you have lost sight of Proverbs 5, verses 18 and 19. Rejoice in the wife of your youth and be exhilarated at all times by her love. Don't let your marriages get boring. And it's not too late, by the way. It's not too late for you. Now, if you're not right with God, if you're not a Christian, it's not too late for you either. You have an opportunity right now, right here, or if you're on the live stream, you reach out to our congregation. We'll have a Bible study. We can get you baptized this very day. If you have a spiritual need, don't wait any longer to deal with it. Get those things resolved. Be right with God. Be confident that when you enter into eternity, that you're going to hear those blessed and wonderful words. Enter into my rest. Whatever spiritual need you have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.